Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to XYZ, the podcast about CNC, automation, robotics, business, and more. My name is Aaron Goff, owner of Goff Custom Knives, and I'm joined by my co-host Nick Frank from the Frank Brothers Guitar Company. How are you, mate?
I'm good. I've missed you.
Yeah, you too, buddy. I'll tell you what, the official theme of today's episode is beer time.
Hey, I'm having one too. What are you drinking?
Stiegel Radlers.
Well, that's fun.
Real man's drink.
Everyone should know that Aaron is shirtless and drinking Radler.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those episodes, people. Yeah, I was running late, so I ran home. And in Ontario at the moment, it's like 90% humidity. Mm-hmm. So by the time I got home, I was just drenched from head to foot. So I actually ran through the shower before jumping on with you.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Not that everyone needed to know that.
Sorry, I just put a weird visual in everyone's head. I'm fully clothed, just saying.
Well, that's thanks.
I'm wearing long sleeves and long pants.
Yeah, you're a weird guy.
It's my beach attire.
How's everything going, man?
It's good. Yeah.
Yeah?
It feels like it's been so long. I don't know. I don't even know what's been up. But I've been running the Haas a lot.
Nice.
And I've been running the Axes as well. So I like these two machines running. I've pitted them against each other.
I can guess which one has been winning.
Yeah.
Yeah. How's it been going though? Like, you've been like actually running production now by the sounds of it.
I've been doing a lot of body stuff.
Exciting.
So we do the arching on the arcade tops, the arching on the, well, we, you know, we're just doing, a, we're pretty much doing everything body related, even cutting out the guitars. We just dialed in our purfling, which is like the inner band that goes around the binding. Mm-hmm. And that's like a custom option. We do like this tortoise shell purfling. That's really cool. So that's just another thing that we've checked off the list. We have moved on to run plastics. So pick guards are pretty well done. Right. I'm sure I've talked about this, but we changed up the way we do it because the pick guard itself has so many custom variables. You know, what type of pickup is going in it. We just made a palette that runs blank, like pick guard shapes, and it does the holes for the screws, chamfers them, and does the chamfer around the perimeter. So it's the shape of the guard, the chamfering is all done, the countersink's done, and then we have a secondary palette that runs the pickup routes. So
cool.
Yeah, it's going to be really efficient. And then we're moving into pickup rings next. Those are just two bottlenecks for us, and so it's happening. We've got palettes, we're making parts. It's been nice.
That is super exciting, buddy.
How about you? You said, well, you had a lot to talk about.
Yeah, last week was a crazy week. So I was supposed to be on vacation, but it was probably the least relaxing week of my entire life.
Oh my God. What happened?
Yeah, it was pretty nuts. So I was on vacation in this little town, and some friends of mine moved there about 6 or 7 months ago. And so my girlfriend and I have been talking about moving outside of the city for quite a while. And this is where we'd like to move because we already have people there. You know, we have a little bit of a support system.
Can you tell us the name of the town?
It's called Bob Cajun.
Oh, Bob Cajun.
In Ontario. It's very cute.
Everyone go listen to the song Bob Cajun by the Tragically Hip. It's pure Canadiana.
Yeah, it's a great little town, you know.
Super cool town.
Yeah, and so I was walking through there and saw a house that would have been perfect for us. 1.5 acre lot, a little house, you know, it's only like 900 square feet upstairs and then a finished basement downstairs, you know, that's like same again. And it had a newly built, really nice, high quality shop. Ooh. Right next to the house.
Yes.
Not a super big shop. It's only 500 square feet, but it's right there. It already has electrical service. Like, it's good to go. You
know? Three phase?
No, unfortunately. So I went from never having seriously looked at real estate to putting in my first offer on a house.
No.
In 2 business days. Like, I went from, like, no mortgage broker, no real estate agent, no nothing, to, like, offer on the house. You know, finances ready.
Oh my God.
2 business days.
That's incredible.
And it was one of the most stressful things I've ever done in my whole fucking life.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we didn't get the house.
Ah, fuck.
But you know what? It may have worked out for the best.
You never get the first one.
Yeah, you know, and like, you know, at the last minute, so I was like, you know, trying to work out where my blind spots were, you know, like what things haven't I checked, blah, 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 you know, because the real estate agent was like, oh, you can totally run a business out of here. The guy was running a business. And I was like, oh, sweet. You know? And then I looked into the zoning bylaws and this place is zoned Hamlet Residential, which is not quite like urban and not quite rural. It's like a relatively rare middle ground.
Oh.
And it turns out one of the bylaw rules for that property is actually that you cannot run a home industry on the property.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I ended up like calling the planning office of like Trent Lakes and like talking to a super lovely guy, you know, being like, okay. And I was just a super straightforward with him. I was like, so sometimes I run this, you know, I have these big machines. Sometimes I use them as a hobby. Sometimes I might use them as a business, you know. If you guys found out I was using them for a business, what's the repercussions? Mm-hmm. You know, and he was like, well, we'd have a building inspector come and, you know, if it's unsafe, we'd issue a notice to comply. And if you refuse to comply, then there'd be fines, you know. And then he was like, you know, we really operate on the, like, be a good neighbor principle.
Right.
You know, so.
Well, that's crux of it. It's no one's ever going to. You're never going to get in any trouble unless you got a neighbor that complains.
Mm-hmm. And once you get into that situation, you're potentially kind of fucked.
You're no fucked, like, whether the law's on your side or not, probably.
Yeah.
I remember hearing a story about a guitar maker who was building guitars out of his garage. And the neighbor just complained, kept complaining, saying that the noise was driving her nuts. And he just was like running a router, which is kind of a noisy machine,
mm-hmm.
but it's a little like a hobby router, pretty much like a
right.
Porter cable. And he like couldn't even hear it himself when he was outside of the house.
Right.
So you just get some person who's a jerk. So, okay, yep. Well, this is huge. The wheels are in motion.
Yeah, so it's exciting. It's terrifying. It's a big leap for us because neither myself nor my girlfriend actually have our driver's licenses.
Mm-hmm.
So we were like putting in an offer on a rural property without having a car or driver's license. Like it was a big step, you know.
And so, what are you going to do about that particular?
We're going to get our licenses and stuff. Like, we just have never had a need to, you know, we're in downtown Toronto. Like,
I didn't get my license until I was like 25 for that same reason. I never needed it.
Yep.
Take the subway everywhere, streetcar, bus.
Yep. Yeah. So, and then, you know, that's led into a chain of things for me. Like, okay, so, you know, I use DHL for all my shipments. Will they pick up there?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do I deal? Like you said, like, you know, it doesn't have three phase. Like, how do I deal with that with all my machines? So yeah, you know, it would have been, in some ways I'm kind of glad that it didn't go through because it would have been a mad scramble.
Right.
you know, super expensive, super brutal kind of process to move a shop, obviously. And then, like, doing it into a situation that's not ideal is even harder. So we'll see. Like, it's going to happen at some point, hopefully soon. But yeah, it was just a crazy process.
That rules. I'm so excited for you.
Thanks, buddy. Yeah, one day. It would be so nice to be able to just, like, roll out of bed, go into the shop, start a cycle, and then, you know, go have a shower.
That is the dream, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that'd be really nice.
Cool. Well, have you looked at any other areas, like, besides Bobcaygeon? Is there, like, a rural, more less hamlety area outside of Bobcaygeon? I'm sure there is.
It turns out that zoning is actually kind of an aberration. Like, the planning department said that in their whole municipality, they only have three small areas, like, three neighborhoods that have that zoning.
So not something you're going to have to be stressed about going forward, necessarily.
No. And, like, literally the house next door to this place was zoned rural.
In rural, you can do whatever the fuck you want?
In a rural zoning in that municipality, you can have a 2,500 square foot accessory building devoted to a home industry.
Oh, sick.
Yeah. Okay. So I could have, like, you know, totally separate service, like electrical service, you know.
Nope.
Whatever I want.
Bigger than 2,500 square feet, though?
Not bigger than... Is that what you said, sorry?
Yeah, no bigger than...
Yeah.
Can you go vertical? Can you do two stories of 2,500 square feet?
I don't know. But, like, for me, 2,500 square feet is still, like, huge.
Oh, yeah. That's plenty of space. That's how big our shop is right now.
Right.
But, yeah, I was just curious, you know.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. You can always apply for, like, an amendment, mm-hmm. you know, to allow you to exceed that. It's just, that's a longer process, you know?
Right. Super cool. So have you been, like, just scouring the internet now for properties?
No, I think I'm ready for a vacation.
Okay. Did you get a little time to relax?
A little bit. It wasn't really that relaxing. It was like the first few days where you're trying to wind down.
Yeah.
And then this happened, you know? So it was like, eh. So, like, I went to work today and I was, like, incredibly unproductive. It was kind of frustrating because my brain is, like, toast.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm, like, you know, still coming down from, because it was only last night that the offer was in. We're, like, waiting to find out what had happened. The real estate agent forgot to call us and tell us that we'd missed.
Come on.
So we're, like, sitting there for, like, 3 hours, and I call him up. I'm like, what's going on? And he's like, oh, I didn't call you?
Oh, my God. Okay, so you're not using him anymore?
Mm-hmm.
So he was just a local realtor?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I have my own, actually, my accountant is a real estate broker.
Oh, okay.
So I actually used him to put the offer in.
Cool.
Yeah, man. Yeah, crazy process. And, like, just the process of getting a mortgage as a small business owner.
Oh, terrible, terrifying.
Honestly, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was.
Good.
Would be, you know? So it was kind of interesting. They had to do what's called a stated income mortgage, where basically they actually use my mortgage for my income from this year, even though I haven't filed it yet. And then I had to provide, like, you know, like, bookkeeping records to prove that my, you know, the income that I was stating was, like, realistic.
Oh, okay. So was that hard to
No, it wasn't. It wasn't too hard at all. It's just bank statements, really. But the nice thing about that is, you know, like, I'm sure for a lot of people last year, you know, height of COVID, for a lot of people that was a shit year, and it was not a great year for me, you know. So, but when I went and talked to the banks rather than the mortgage broker, the banks were like, "Oh, you had a large discrepancy in your income between 2020 and 2019, yeah. So we have to take the lower of the two."
Right.
We can't use an average. We can't look back further back. No, just like, we're just going to use your lowest ever, like, stated income, you know? Mm-hmm. I was like, great. So yeah, it's very, very interesting process.
I was going through a similar situation last summer. Mm. And yeah, I was just nervous about the whole thing. It ended up working out, but.
Oh, that's good.
You always just assume they're going to... The man is going to screw the little guy.
Well, and that's what happens a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, apart from that, like, I don't have a whole lot to report on my end since the last episode in terms of like machining stuff,
right?
Because I really haven't done that much since then, you know. But yes, I'm still very excited about my hydraulic tool holders.
Ah, yeah. Okay, I have the bug, and I want one, and I can't. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to justify it.
So actually, I saw something the other day that got me super excited for you, which is that Haas just released indexable ball nose cutters in their Haas tooling.
Okay,
line. I'm not sure if you saw that.
I didn't. I've been curious about those.
Yeah, because they might be flute, good for your right? application. Yes.
Which is good. Yep. This isn't bad for us. I mean, I've never used a straight flute ball nose, but straight flute tends to be all right for wood.
Right. But very reasonably priced compared to the other like indexable ball nose mills that I've seen. So, and they have them in diameters up to like 1.5 inches.
Cool. Well, so I had a little visit from our friendly neighborhood Haas rep.
Oh, yes.
Fabrizio, mm-hmm. Which is great. I like the guy. Who's could catch up and show him the progress we've made on the machine. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, Haas tooling is not available in Canada yet, but Serco Machinery, who he works for, that's the HFO in Ontario,
right?
Can bring it in. So, because I was talking to him about wanting a shell mill.
Right.
And he said, check out what we've got. And if you want us to bring something in, I can do that for you. So I probably could get my hands on an indexable ball nose, mm-hmm. Which is an interesting idea because, well, I don't know how well it would work for us. For the half inch ball nose we use is a 2-flute helical. It's got a really slow helix, and we use a lot of the length of the flute for so we do these pockets for the electronics cavity, and we mill it all out with a square end mill, rough it all out, and then we have a radius bottom, so we finish it with the ball nose, and we actually cut the entire wall, which is 1.5 inches tall at least,
right,
with the edge of the length of the ball nose, like, so we get this really smooth wall finish plus a round over on the bottom, or sorry, a radius on the bottom,
right? And from memory, I believe that the indexable ball noses do actually have like a short vertical section on the insert. So one thing you could do now that you've got such a fast machine is just like, you know, crank up the RPM and then do like a ramped contour around the outside, so you'd make multiple passes to form your flat wall,
right?
But you know, because you can really move, it'd be pretty quick.
Yeah,
but
it's nice to take one full depth pass at the very end. Mm-hmm. It makes it just the edge finish is beautiful, and it's seamless with the radius at the bottom.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that being said, we use a ball nose for, I posted some videos. I should have posted them to the XYZ Instagram, but I posted a video of the heel contouring. So the heel is the portion where, I mean, you know this, but the heel is the portion where, you know, the neck, the shaft of the neck goes up into the heel, and then the heel meets the body. And we have this contoured blended heel where it blends seamlessly into the body, and that's all done with a ball nose, and it's mostly using just the tip of it, so it could be a good application for that.
Mm-hmm.
I like the idea of keeping tools sharp.
Yes, sure.
And
it's not having to replace a whole tool.
It's a $140 tool, that ball nose that we're using,
right? Whereas if I remember correctly, the inserts for like the 1-inch diameter Haas ball nose were like $35 US.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's just one insert, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty good value. I mean, and we would only need a 1/2 inch. Do they make it that small?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, they go down to like 7/16.
Oh, okay.
Or 5/16 or something. Like, they go quite small.
Right. Nice. Yeah, well, that's a really good thing, or a good option. I should look into that.
So you were saying before that you've got the hydraulic tool holder bug now. Have you bought any?
No, but okay, so this is probably totally impractical because I honestly don't think we really need it for what hydraulic is built for.
Right.
We do a final cutout of the guitar body, and it needs to be perfect. And so what I want to have is we rough out the body with a, you know, half inch end mill, and then finish it with a different tool that's only meant for finishing.
Yeah.
And I was like, maybe that's a good application for the hydraulic. Cause we, I don't, you know, the tool will probably still last a long time because we're not going to be cutting a lot with it. Mm-hmm. But what are the properties of what are the benefits of hydraulic other than fast tool changes? Like if you want to replace the end mill.
Well, so, you know, as I was saying last episode, like people have always told me, oh, they have the best vibration damping. I think what they actually mean is it has like the best stiffness because the tool holder body is huge.
Is that
like,
okay?
Really, yeah. You know, so it's coupling that tool into the spindle really, really tightly.
So that would be probably a benefit for us.
For sure. But honestly, I think in your application, particularly given that you're probably talking about like a relatively large square end mill, right?
Yeah, so it's a 2.5-inch length of cut is the one I kind of want. Mm. Right now, we're using one with a 2-inch length of cut.
It's what diameter?
Half inch, and the one what we use now is a half inch single flute upcut with a 2-inch length of cut.
Right.
And the one I'm looking at is 3-flute super slow helix, like 22 degrees. And 2.5-inch length of cut. Which is honestly, a little bit more than I need. But
sure. I would say run it in an end mill holder. Like you're going to get like really good contact in an end mill holder. You don't really have the cutting forces.
Yeah,
to
it just doesn't have the welding flat.
Mm. Who are you getting the tool
this from? One that I'm looking at is from Harvey.
Okay. Do they not offer a service to put welding flats on?
I mean, maybe you could ask for it, but it does. It's not a stock thing, I think, and it would probably cost a couple bucks more.
Yeah, like literally a couple of bucks there.
Yeah, but why not put it in a hydraulic then? If I'm going to be, you know.
I guess. Like you're talking about the difference between like an $80 tool holder and like a $200 and something dollar tool holder. But yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, what I'll probably end up doing, honestly, is just putting it in a call it and the holder. I'm just dreaming.
Just dreaming. Well, one thing I would say, if you do decide to do it, so you can get... I'm not sure if Maritool has both yet, but you can get the hydraulic holders with a 1/2-inch bore and a 3/4-inch bore.
Yes.
And then you can get sleeves in either size to, you know, but reducing sleeves, right?
Yeah.
So you could put that 1/2-inch tool in a 1/2-inch tool holder.
Right.
With no sleeve.
Yeah.
But I would definitely say don't do that.
Yeah, I've heard that that's not as good an idea as just having the sleeve.
Yeah, I mean, having a sleeve, like, potentially makes it run out a little bit more, but, like, you know, like, these things are ground to such tight tolerances, I wouldn't be worried about that, really. Like, the reason I would say to make sure you use a sleeve is because that way, if you do somehow crash the tool, it's most likely it's going to trash the sleeve and leave your tool holder untouched, you know, whereas if you, like, you know, fuck up the bore in that tool holder, then it's toast.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, that honestly, that's one of the, in my mind now, that's probably one of the biggest advantages that they have over like an end mill holder, because, you know, end mill holders are always the actual size of the tool and, you know, you do tend to damage them. Like if you break a tool off or something, you'll scar up the inside of the end mill holder.
Yeah. Mark and I were talking about this, because we're just talking about tool life management. And how we never break tools, like it's so rare.
Yeah, sure.
Other than maybe our smallest tool, which is 23 thou.
Right, which just disappears, doesn't even make any noise or anything.
Exactly. Yeah, it just gets stuck in the part and then it carries on. Mm-hmm. But because of that, we sometimes we need to be more observant about the like edge finish and stuff like that, because you could just be running a dull tool forever. It's still just going to move the wood away.
Yeah. Yeah.
I forget where I was going with that. But yeah, so an end mill holder probably wouldn't be problematic for us, because we're not going to break tools really.
So I actually had a problem 2 weeks ago, I think it was, where, so one of the things that I'm doing with my G10, which is the composite material that I use for my handle scales, I'm actually processing. So I get like sheets of that from my supplier that are 8.5 by 11.5 inches. And they're like 3/8 of an inch thick. And I used to kind of cut those up on a tile saw, using a diamond blade and water to keep the dust down. And that worked pretty well. But one of the things that I'm trying to do at the moment is, when I'm cutting that down into like the rectangular blanks that I use for my handles, I'm keeping the size really, really accurate. And especially in thickness, so that I have this system where I can just put a liner in, to a jig, put some glue in there, put a handle scale on there, and then glue it up. And overnight I have a sandwich, you know, a beautiful knife sandwich ready for the morning. But the problem is that, so I've used a whole bunch of different tools trying to find one that would work. I've used 4-flute. So I'm using a 1/8 inch end mill to kind of cut the slots that make the, the big rectangle into smaller rectangles. Right. But G10's like super hard on tools. It dulls them.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as they start to get dull, the flutes pack up and it just snaps the tool off.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I went through like 4 or 5 tools in like a 2-day period. Yeah. Which, you know, sent me off on a journey, because I was like, okay, I know that there are tools meant for G10 because they use it all the time in circuit boards, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm pretty sure that you guys get your fret slotting bits from precisebits.com, right?
We do.
Correct. So they have a whole line of end mills specifically designed for cutting G10.
Oh, cool.
And they have like two types. They have like, it's like a burr. It's not like a normal end mill.
Yes.
It's like a burr. Okay. So it has like 7 flutes, and then each flute is actually like serrated.
Yeah, I've seen this. It looks like a grinding sort of tool for a Dremel.
Yeah. But those things are supposed to get, they actually rate their lifetime in linear inches.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like 1,200 linear inches out of a tool. You know, which is, that's a hell of a lot more than I was getting out of these little
things.
What's
the diameter?
1/8.
Okay, yeah.
Funnily enough, though, it turns out that McMaster actually stock these tools.
Okay.
In their, like, router bits section. You know, because, like, precise bits seem great, but, like, I'm going to have to, like, place a separate order with them, wait, it's going to be, like, weird shipping and all sorts of shit.
You have a kink for McMaster car.
Everyone has a kink for McMaster car. Come on. So I've got one of those in my cart right now. They're not expensive.
Though. What does it cost? Bucks.
$11.
Oh, psh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So rather than being in there, the reason I never found that is because it's in their router bits section, not in their end mill section.
Oh, that's like, that's what woodworkers call end mills. Yeah. I actually have had to for this podcast change my vocabulary, because we'd always call them fucking router bits.
Right.
I don't know what it is.
That's fair. But yeah, they have them up to 1/2 inch diameter and 2 1/8 inch length of cut.
Oh, sick. I got to look these up, because I've got something in my mind for what it looks like. But okay, so the thing about precise bits where you might want to reconsider is if you're if you're going through a lot of them, I'm pretty sure they give you bulk discounts.
Oh, okay.
Because we buy, like, we'll buy like 10, 23 thou end mills that we use to fret slot and a few other different things. Yeah, we'll buy them like 10 at a time. They come in a cute little case.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think you get a price break.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I have used precise bits in the past. I can't remember what for, but I know I bought the stuff. And they were great. So yeah, if anyone you know, is looking for something like that, then 100% they are an interesting supplier for those weird kind of like circuit board drills and
yeah. Oh yeah. Okay. I'm looking at them now. Yeah. This is cool, but cool router bit.
Yeah. And so they said that like that kind of burr design is very specific for cutting G10 because it has like the serrations to allow it to cut the fibers, and then, you know, the gullets are specifically designed to move away the like soft fluffy chips while still having a really large core in the tool to resist the cutting forces.
Right.
So yeah, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, I'm
what kind of you don't care about edge finish either.
Not really, no. It's a roughing operation.
Yeah.
You know, so
made from sub micro grain tungsten carbide.
Yeah. So we'll see. That should be fun. Should be interesting.
Yeah, sick. well, I'll be curious to see how that goes. Yeah, it is a pretty stiff looking tool. Like the gullet's pretty small.
Yeah.
It almost looks asymmetrical.
The tool?
Yeah. Well, no, like the, if I'm looking, they have a photo on precisebits.com of the end of it, but it kind of looks like it's spinning. Like, anyways, go look at it. precisebits.com, chip breaker router bits.
Yeah, it's actually a very cool website. They've got some pretty unusual stuff on there that you wouldn't really see outside of like the circuit board industry.
It's kind of a hilarious website too. So
it's a bit weird,
kind of old school. The color scheme is funny.
That's fine though.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, I love being just able to click to buy, and that's what these guys do.
Yes, 100%. So on that note, you know, one of the things that's kind of a bottleneck for me at the moment is that like I have all these little processes that I'd really love to like take off of my VMCs because the VMCs should be hard milling. They should be hard milling 24 hours a day, you know. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't be doing like G10 cutting or like Kydex cutting. Mm-hmm. Like they should be doing something that's like suited to their build, you know. So I've been like fucking around more and more. You know, I want to build a CNC. It's been like my dream for the longest time to design and build a CNC machine from the ground up. And one of the things that's really been stopping me is the spindle. You know, because
you want to have tool changer.
I want to have a tool changer.
Yeah,
100%.
Of course.
And, you know, so you can buy like BT30 spindles off like AliExpress, and they're actually pretty decent from what I've heard. But they come, like, you have like a pneumatic piston above the spindle to knock the tool out. And, you know, that pneumatic cylinder is like the same height as the spindle. So you end up with a stack that's like, you know, 2 feet tall for this tiny little spindle. So I've been trying for the longest time to work out how to package like the spindle, the motor, and the pneumatic actuation for the tool release, you know, in a compact package. And I finally have worked out how to do it, which I'm super excited about.
Is this something you can share?
Yeah, yeah.
Is this going to be open source?
Yes, it is. So basically, the spindle and the... so I'm actually going to be using a 1-horsepower brushless servo to drive the spindle.
Will it be belt driven?
Yes.
Cool.
Yeah. And one of the reasons that using the servo is really cool is because when I'm doing the orientation of the spindle, it means that I don't have to... So like on the Fidal, you have like a little piston that engages in kind of like a slot in the spindle to stop it from spinning and to like force the orientation. But that's kind of this like weird, noisy, clanky mechanism that's always got like contact and impact on every tool change. It's kind of nasty. Whereas with a servo, I can just have like an encoder on the spindle and then say, you know, rotate to this position. Done. And the servo will hold it in that orientation. So the servo and the spindle are mounted parallel to each other with the servo in behind the spindle. It's a little bit shorter. Inside the kind of like head casting, like the head assembly. And then on top of that, there'll be a cap that goes like a rectangular shaped cap that's the same kind of shape as the head of the machine. And on the underside of that, there'll be a lever. And on the end of the lever, one end there'll be a pivot, the other end there'll be a pneumatic actuator that has a relatively short stroke, only about 1 inch. And then in the middle, it has a place to push down on the drawbar of the spindle. So you get force amplification. like one of the biggest issues with this application is that you need like 600 or 700 pounds of force out of a pneumatic cylinder, which means that normally you need a really big diameter pneumatic cylinder. But in this case, I can use that lever to amplify the force, shorten the stroke, amplify the force, and, you know, have enough force to do the tool release.
Okay.
All in about 2.5 inches of height.
It's like a Da Vinci's solution to this problem. You use some old school technology.
Honestly, it'll be very, very simple. Like, once you see it, you'll be like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to picture it, but I'm making a screwed up face trying to like imagine what you just said.
Scrunching your face up.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah, and it's something I'm thinking more and more about. And honestly, like thinking about moving out to the country and having potentially somewhat limited access to power, again, it makes even more sense. You know, like this would be a CNC machine that could run off like a 120 outlet.
Right. Yeah. That's such a cool
standard household outlet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, I'm not a Haas fanboy, although I sound like one, but like their mini mills mm-hmm. and their tool room mills both run off of
single phase, which is super nice. Yeah.
They just actually came out with a new tool room mill. A T0.
Yes, I saw that actually. It's a very cool little machine.
And it's like less than 20. It's like $25,000, and with a tool changer, it's $30,000 US.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's it getting into like Tormach territory.
That's yeah. I'm worried for Tormach because it's a pretty good deal.
Mm-hmm.
The machine looks cool. I mean, this is because the machine that you're talking about building is something that I would consider, like, I think I could have a use for, multiple uses for. Right. And it would be depending on the price point. I mean, but like, I'm imagining you're going for a lower price point.
Yes. Like, I don't know, like the bill of materials would probably still be like $10,000,
mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure what that would work out to be at, like, retail price. Right.
Like,
but
yeah.
Double or something,
but pretty impressive Haas putting out a like machine like that with tool changing for $30,000. Still a lot of money.
It is, but you know what, like if you get a machine that needs three phase and you don't have three phase,
mm-hmm.
Then like that's a big expense of its own. Like getting a phase converter is like a phase perfect phase converter is thousands of dollars,
right?
Like the I think the smallest one I looked at was for 10 horsepower, and that was $3,000 US.
Yeah. But, okay, so if you move to the country, you're going to take your Fedals.
Mm-hmm.
What choice do you have?
So, this is actually kind of funny. Fedals from the factory, pretty much all Fedals, except for the very high torque machines, could be configured to run on single phase.
Come on. Fedal is a funny company. I keep hearing every time you talk about them, they seem like an open source,
right?
Like thing.
So all of the servos in the machine, 100%. All the servos in the machine, the input to the servo cage and the input to the control electronics is all 120-volt single phase. So the only thing in the machine, like the coolant pumps from the factory were single phase as well. And that's kind of unusual. A lot of like the bigger coolant pumps are all three phase
mm-hmm.
on other machines.
But you don't even use that.
No, I don't. But if somebody else is, then I'm trying to be helpful.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. You bastard.
I'm selfish.
Yeah. Yeah. And the only thing that's three phase in the machine is the spindle drive. And so I actually reached out to Dave DeCarson at Fedal Parts about this today because, this is something I'm actively thinking about. And they have a diagram showing how the single phase transformer was wired into the machine. And it only shows single phase going to the spindle inverter. And a lot of spindle inverters, like a lot of variable frequency drives, can actually just take single phase input and then output three phase. Because it doesn't matter whether they're taking single phase or three phase, they're converting all of that power to DC and then returning it back into three phase.
So why make it three phase?
Because it powers just because cheaper? It's more efficient power delivery. Yeah.
Yeah.
So my, like, no one quote me on this yet. I'm going to look into this a lot more because it's something I'm actively pursuing. But my impression is that in most Vidals, you can actually take the transformer out entirely if your voltage matches up with what the electronics want and go straight from the disconnect through the surge protector and then into the spindle drive, into the servo and the control PC. And then run it off single phase completely.
Well, that would be a problem solver.
Yeah. So, and one other interesting thing is, so my two machines, one's a VMC15, one's a VMC10. The VMC15 is rated at 15 horsepower, but it has a 10 horsepower spindle motor in it.
Right. It's rated for 10 and has 10?
It's rated for 15 and has 10.
Okay.
So the reason they do this, like, basically they like, you know, the motor can handle more power for a short period of time. Does that make sense?
The motor.
You know, if you're taking a cut that's like 30 seconds long and it's a, you know, a 15 horsepower cut, the machine will do it. Like the spindle motor will just.
You just can't do that all day.
Exactly, right? My other machine, which is a VMC10, is electrically the same, but one of the changes that they made to that, so it doesn't have an enclosure, and I think one of the changes that they made to that was they actually only put a 5-horsepower motor in it.
Hmm.
And I cannot tell the difference between those two machines in terms of performance at all.
Really?
Like, I don't do enough heavy cuts right. to notice, right? So I actually have brand new Glentec servo drive, spindle drives in both of those machines. And those Glentec drives are actually configurable. So you just like literally turn a dial and it changes the complete configuration. Like you can tell it, oh, it's a 10 horsepower, 10,000 RPM spindle drive, or it's a, you know, 5 horsepower, 7,500 RPM spindle drive. And one thing that you can do with a three phase motor is you can actually run it on a VFD that's smaller than the motor. Like you'll lose power, obviously. But you can run like a 10 horsepower motor on a 5 horsepower VFD. You just get 5 horsepower. Out
of it. Okay. It doubles right? it down.
So yeah, exactly. So in my case, like I don't need 10 horsepower. I never, like I've done all the calculations for how much power my cuts consume and they're all less than 1 horsepower.
Hmm.
So what I'm going to try doing is actually just like changing the configuration on the Glentec drive on my bigger machine down to 5 horsepower. And then convert both of them to single phase. And the advantage of doing that is that it would mean that I can put them on smaller breakers. Right? So like, you know, let's say I end up in a shop that only has 100 amp, 240 volt single phase. Rather than having to put those machines on 60 amp breakers each.
Right.
You know, I could put them on a 40 each.
Okay. Yeah.
Obviously, you can actually have like, so you have like the main breaker in the panel, which will be 100 amps. And then you have all of your other breakers. And the sum of all of those other breakers will pretty much always be more than the main breaker. Because it's assumed that you're not pulling
all at once
full current from all at once. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
like when you have your, you know, kettle and your toaster oven plugged into the same outlet.
Exactly. Bad times ensue.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, if anyone's listening to this and thinking about doing the same thing, one thing you have to be really careful of is to never undersize your wiring. Like, your breaker, you know, I am not an electrician. Don't take anything I say as professional advice. I'm an idiot. Don't listen to me. But, you know, the circuit breaker always has to be the weak point in the circuit. Now, that being said, in my last shop, I asked the electrician to hook up a temporary circuit for my screw compressor, which takes 600 volt three phase. And he ran 15 amp wires to the machine and then put it on a 30 amp breaker.
Sounds no good.
That is very, very no bueno. So if your electrician ever does something like that, immediately fire them.
What happened? Did you notice?
I did notice, and it was fine. I luckily didn't really have to use it for more than like a couple of weeks because I was just getting that compressor up and running.
Is it just what he had? Did he know he fucked up?
I have no idea. But like, you know, putting undersized wiring on a circuit is such a bad and dangerous thing to do.
Right.
But that wasn't the only bad and dangerous thing that he did to me in my shop. One of the other funny things that he did was all of the electrical work in my shop was done in conduit. So they're pulling individual wires through like metal conduit. And technically, I believe, under code, you can use the conduit as your ground rather than pulling a separate ground, right? And that's what he did. But that means that the conduit has to be bonded to like your disconnect in such a way that that ground is like, you know, electrically conductive.
Right.
Right. It has to be done properly. He bonded it to the Fidal disconnects, which are painted steel.
Oh, no.
Right. So I'd been running this machine for like a year. And then when I was taking the machine out, I looked in the disconnect. I'd never thought to double check, you know, a licensed master electrician's work. And I looked in the disconnect and I'm like, there's no separate grounding wire. Oh, he must be using the EMT conduit. And then I'm like, but the EMT conduit is attached to the machine on a painted surface. Like there's no metal to metal contact.
Right.
Yeah, it boggles my mind. So, I did check with a multimeter and there was continuity. So he must have, like, you know, talked it down hard enough that he broke the paint there somewhere, but I'm very sure that's not up to code.
Yeah, and did he check with the multimeter?
Fuck that.
So we had the opposite thing. When we when we had the Haas installed, there was confusion between the electrician and Haas about the ground. So there was, from the transformer, cables running, and it, you know, I'm not that knowledgeable about this stuff at all, but it was grounded to the electronics, the electrical cabinet of the Haas.
Right.
But the Haas directions, which this electrician was going by, said that it needed to be grounded to the base or something like that. So Buddy took that as gospel and drilled a hole in the casting.
Right.
And he did remove the paint in a really disgusting fashion, like just like a just like fucking ground away a bunch of paint from our beautiful new machine, and ran a separate ground that wasn't from the transformer, which was already grounded to the chassis. He ran it directly to the building ground.
So don't you just have a ground loop then?
Sorry?
You've got two grounds going
we're
to the machine.
We're grounded right? to all, you know, like we're hella grounded.
Well, the problem is if you have two grounds, I mean, they're going back to the same place, but two grounds is not
better.
Usually allowed because ground can be at different potential. You know, so it's like, you know, when I'm standing in my building, I'm standing on the ground, but I'm three stories up. You are one story down and you are standing on the ground. You know, we are both grounded, but we're at different potentials. We have different amount of energy.
Right.
So if you have a ground loop, you can actually have current flowing through the ground because you have it grounded at two different potentials, if that makes sense. So normally, you know, more than one ground is no bueno.
Okay. Well, fuck. I don't know, man. Now you're stressing me out.
Oh, no, no. It'll be fine. Because both of them are going back to the panel.
Both of them are going back to the power. Yeah.
Yeah. So the times when this causes issues is, so like there have been famous cases of, you know, musicians being electrocuted on stage because they touch their lips to the mic.
Right.
And the mic is hooked up to an amplifier that's on a different circuit and has like a different ground than their guitar. You know, so they end up with a ground loop going from their guitar through their body to the microphone.
Right.
Right. And that's unusual, but.
Well, I've seen Tim get electrocuted once.
Was it funny?
Yeah. he was playing. We just bought this amp. It was like from 1951, a Fender amp. And, what was the issue? Oh, it just didn't have a ground, like, you know, they didn't even have ground, like the plug. Like a 3-prong plug. And I don't know what was up with the thing. Like, it was, you know, it's an old ass amp. Something was wrong. And the minute he touched the strings and what else? He touched something else. And just closed a circuit or something. Just the energy just traveled through him. And he got buzzed.
Yeah, so the particularly with old school tube amps, especially single-ended tube amps, like Class A tube amps, you're... The zero point in your waveform, so like the crossing point in your waveform, is actually at an elevated voltage. So you imagine like the voltage is 0 volts to 200 volts. The place where the sine wave crosses zero is actually at 100 volts. And then you have to use what's called a decoupling capacitor to get rid of that 100 volts of DC. So you end up with an AC output after the decoupling capacitor. But if something's gone wrong and the capacitor is like shorted or something, then you're just getting 100 volts all the time on the output.
Yeah, it didn't cook them or anything. It just gave them a little bit of a surprise.
My most recent surprise, I've gotten past the point, thankfully, where I electrocute myself for the most part. But I was working on my iMac, of all things, an older one where you could actually like take the screen out and then swap the hard drives and stuff. And there is a particular step with iMacs where you unplug them from the main power and then you hold down the power button for 10 seconds. And that actually activates like a discharge resistor to discharge all of the capacitors in the power supply and in the backlight.
So that you can work on it?
Yeah, so you can work on it. And I thought I'd done that, but I must have forgotten to. And I like reached into the machine and just got like, I had one hand on the case of the machine and I touched something and got like full whack through both arms, which is like the worst possible way to get electrocuted. And yeah, I felt real shaky for a while after that.
Damn. Yeah. I saw an electrician. They were hooking up our 600 volt, jointer. 600 volt. That makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. And, he fucked up, took a pretty big jolt and, he was like, I just thought like, I saw him just like walk pacing back and forth in the driveway, smoking a cigarette. And I asked the other electrician, I was like, what's up with the guy? He looks stressed. And he just was like, yeah, he took a big shock.
Jesus.
Don't even think he needed a lighter volt mains to light the cigarette.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, 600 volt mains is not something you want to fuck with.
Yeah, the other guy said something about like, oh, he was like, he wasn't like touching something else, so like he didn't take the full current or something like that. So, because otherwise...
You got lucky.
Yeah.
Otherwise you would have had a...
Otherwise it could have stopped his heart.
Ex-electrician in your shop.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I mean, for anyone listening, like, to do electrical work, even, you know, as I said, even on consumer goods, sometimes, like, you really do have to be careful. And, you know, I sound flippant about it in this case because it's funny, but, like, I am always genuinely cautious when doing any kind of electrical work. And thankfully, that has resulted in no major shocks for me. Yeah, it's so easy to fuck it up. And give yourself a good whack, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, every electrician's had one. I worked for a contractor when like I was 21 or something like that. And he had these wire cutters that were just like metal. They didn't have like an insulated handle or anything like that. And they just had this huge wire shaped hole in the middle of the where the wire cutters cut. And I asked him about it, and he said it was the electrical current just burned a hole in the wire cutters and also cooked him. It's because changing a light fixture or something like that. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You have to be extremely careful.
Yeah.
So yes, if you don't know what you're doing, don't do electrical work. And if you do know what you're doing, still be careful.
Yeah, I always hire an electrician. I think there's a law here that you can't, you can do electrical work if you own the property, but otherwise there no.
Is, yeah. Yeah. And that's actually one thing that I'm really looking forward to is that once I own my own shop, I'll be able to pull permits, do electrical work, have it inspected, like do it myself, mm-hmm. but do it all above board.
Yeah.
You know, cause electricians are expensive.
Super expensive. And I mean, this is the funny thing. Every time we bring the electricians in to do something, they're always like, huh, never done this before. Like install like, a fan oh, for in our great. Spray booth or right. shit like that. And it's like, I mean, it's all like, I guess when you know, you boil it down to the basic elements of what electrical work is, it's maybe not straightforward, but it's kind of all the same. Like there's some basic rules.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing that bothers me is just, you know, so in the last shop, that electrician, like I specifically saw itemized items on the invoices that he gave mm-hmm. me for permits and inspection. And in hindsight, I don't think that either of those things were done, you know, because so I've had other electricians tell me that some electricians are certified to self-inspect.
Oh, okay.
Which sounds interesting.
Yeah. But, kind of erodes.
Mark your own test, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Not very scientific.
No. But, you know, if that was the case, then, you know, I don't think that that grounding issue on my Fidal would have really passed. And I definitely don't think that the circuit for my screw compressor would have passed muster.
Mm-hmm. You know? It doesn't sound like it.
No. So, yeah, I'm just... You know, that's one of the things. Like, you pay for a professional, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're getting someone who's acting professional.
No.
You know?
Yeah.
So
every time we bring these guys, the electricians in, it's always there's always some confusion over something, and they ask me questions, and I'm like, I'm not a fucking electrician.
Why are you asking?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Nick, are you ready to talk about space now?
Hit me.
I've gone all of this time. I've been so patient, just waiting to talk about space.
And I haven't looked at, I don't know anything about what's been happening. So,
okay, so we might actually have to like take this into next week because I think we're already like running close to time. But the last like 2 weeks have been insane for space stuff. Insane.
What's happening? Who are the movers and shakers?
Well, SpaceX, of course. They're the biggest ones.
Your favorite.
The Wooden Spoon Prize. So in Australia, we have this thing called the Wooden Spoon Prize, which looking back on it, it's quite mean-spirited. You get the wooden spoon when you're lost.
Right. Did you get those? Normally here in Canada, they give kids participation ribbons.
Oh, no. When I was in high school, you got the wooden spoon. It's like the opposite.
Poor little Aaron.
And I personally got several wooden spoons. mainly for things that involved exercise. Yeah, I know. So Boeing, you know, we all know Boeing. They're a huge company. They are one of two companies that won the commercial crew program contracts to help NASA deliver goods and astronauts to the International Space Station.
Okay.
So it's Boeing and SpaceX, the two companies. Now, SpaceX has made tons of deliveries to the International Space Station. No problems. They've had two crewed missions. No problems. Boeing, on the other hand, have not had such good luck, unfortunately. So they have a program called Starliner, which was supposed to go to the International Space Station to take cargo. I don't think it's actually made a cargo mission yet. I'm just going to double check that as we talk. But I don't think it's even made a cargo mission, which is hilarious.
What's up with these big, you know, aerospace companies?
Too big to fail, I think.
Right.
You know? So the really telling thing, though, in my mind, and honestly, if I was an astronaut, I would not be trying to get my frequent flyer card with Boeing at this point. They were supposed to launch their first mission to the ISS the other day, and they literally had the rocket on the launch stand, and then there was a malfunction on the International Space Station. The latest Russian module that was attached called Nauka, accidentally fired its reaction control thrusters and started like rotating the whole space station like out of control.
Cool, but it's terrifying. Yeah,
bad times. So they were able to fix that, but because of that issue, they scrubbed, like they delayed the Starliner launch, right?
So this is just bad luck for Boeing.
Yeah, yeah. At this point, to this part of the story, it's bad luck for Boeing. But then they were looking at, you know, so they've already gone, they had literally gone through all of the pre-flight checks. Like they had said everything was ready to go, right? And then after the delay, they went through the checks again and found that 18 valves in the flight abort system were not in the positions that the valves were reporting to the flight computer.
And how bad is that? Anything malfunctioning sounds bad, but.
Yeah, so the flight abort system is like a big rocket that goes off when it's instructed to carry the astronauts to safety with like a crazy 10G burn, like to get them away from the rest of the rocket.
Oh, cool.
So, but if that rocket fires at the wrong time, uh-oh, like for instance, when you're docking with the International Space Station, then it's just going to drive the whole capsule at like a 10G burn into the ISS. And, you know, potentially kill everyone on board or something like that, right? So it's kind of mind-boggling that they found this deep of a problem after the system was already supposed to have been launched.
Right. It's surprising that, A, we know about that and then bury it somehow, but B, that they even, like, went through these check processes again, like...
You have to do. I mean, it sounds like it was additional checks.
That's what I'm saying. Like, why did they do that?
Because they didn't find it. I don't know. Because they didn't find it the first time around. You know, maybe there was a malfunction. Maybe they froze in position or, you know, after being actuated.
Right. Or yeah, yeah. Some little thing made them want to double check it, triple check it.
But at this point, the Starliner launch is delayed indefinitely.
Hmm.
Which is kind of brutal. Like, so the SpaceX Crew Dragon, costs, I think it's $55 million per astronaut to get people to the International Space Station.
How much?
$55 million.
Wow.
The Starliner costs $90 million.
Oof.
and you know, like NASA are paying for that and they haven't delivered. Like it's kind of nuts.
Damn.
Yeah, so I'm just looking at the... Yeah, so there's only been two missions that have actually happened so far, and they're both listed as part... Like, two flights, and they're both listed as partial failures.
Ouch, that's gonna sting the ego of Boeing.
Seriously. So it's kind of crazy. And then on the other hand, we have SpaceX, who are... I sound like a total fanboy here.
You are.
I am a fan, but... I'm not like unconditionally a fan, you know, like if they do something like dumb, like, so for instance, Starlink, the Starlink satellites have been interfering with astronomical observations because they reflect too much sunlight.
Oh.
You know, that's kinda
lame, yeah.
Yeah. And they're working to correct it, but like, that's not great.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to be like, oh, yeah, what
but you know, anymore. They don't seem like the type of company that would want to do that and be like, well, fuck you, we're a, you know.
I don't think so, but I think they also have different priorities to some extent, you know, so we'll see. I want them to fix that, obviously. But SpaceX have just been crushing it.
Mm-hmm.
So they're down in Boca Chica, Texas is where they're assembling Starship, their new launch system. And last week, for the first time, they fully stacked, like they fully assembled this system. Mm-hmm. So it's the Starship on top of the Super Heavy booster. And that whole stack stands like 150 meters tall or something.
God damn.
Like it's 9 meters in diameter. It's the largest rocket system humanity has ever made. It's insane. They have 2 out of 3 of the world's largest cranes on site doing construction of the rockets and of the launch tower and stuff. So like you see photos of this thing from a distance and you're like, oh, that, yeah, that's big. But then there's this YouTube channel called Everyday Astronaut, which is super, super cool, very fun to watch. And the guy that runs that channel, Tim Dodd, apparently, like, you know, can call up Elon because he actually ended up getting a personal tour through all of the construction facilities.
Oh man, I want to see Elon
as the tour guide. It's a really cool video. It's 2.5 hours.
Do you see like the manufacturing facility?
Every single part of not of the engines.
Okay.
But all of the manufacturing for the.
So what kind of machinery are we talking about?
It's all like welding and rolling equipment.
Boring.
But it's on this like ridiculous scale.
But do you see like mills and.
No, there, because there aren't any on that site.
True.
At least as far as I saw, you know.
I want to see like where they're making like the critical, precise tolerance stuff.
I would like to see inside the rocket engine, inside the rocket engine factory.
Yeah. Yes. They can't be making everything too. Like they've got to be contracting a lot of stuff out to aerospace machine shops.
I don't think that that's the case.
Really?
Like, yeah.
So where is that? I want to see that tour. Where are the mills? Where are the lathes?
You know, like one of the things that SpaceX and Tesla both do is vertical integration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like they try to keep as much stuff in-house as possible in order to have control over every little bit. And actually, one of the anecdotes that Elon was talking about during the tour was actually a really good example of why that's helpful. So he said that he was like sleeping in the factory at Tesla during the ramp up of Model 3 production. And there was one particular manufacturing cell that was like the bottleneck for the whole factory. And it was this automated system with like three robot arms for placing a fiberglass mat on top of the battery pack. So, you know, it had to be like this soft mat, like kind of wrangled into the battery pack and then glued down and so on. And so he said he spent like 3 or 4 days, like, you know, making the robots a bit faster and like, you know, trying to squeak every second out of this process. And then he was like, hang on a second, like, what is this even for? You know, and so he asked the battery pack team, like, and they're like, oh, it's for noise and vibration. And he's like, oh, okay. And then he went to the noise and vibration team and he's like, so what's this mat for? And they were like, oh, no, it's not for noise and vibration. It's for fire safety. Like, go talk to the battery pack. And then the end result of this was they removed the mat and deleted that entire manufacturing cell and just like got rid of the bottleneck.
Sack.
Like it just wasn't needed at all.
That's funny. Right?
And I think if you had like, you know, a company outside, you know, like an outside contractor making your battery packs, like that optimization probably would have never happened.
It seems like the kind of thing where it's like, you know, Ford would be like, well, I mean, we've got all these, you know, mats. We bought 1,000 mats.
Gotta use them.
10,000 mats. Yeah.
But yeah, so like, honestly, like just from a thinking standpoint, like thinking about manufacturing, I thought that the tour was really cool.
Cool. I'm going to watch it. That's it.
Yeah. And the last, so it's actually in three parts. The first two parts are like an hour long each, which is kind of nuts. The third part is like 25 minutes or something. And, Tim, like the guy that runs the YouTube channel, actually didn't get to talk to Elon much during that 25 minutes because Elon gets like sidetracked by one of the construction site managers at Starbase. But he just lets Tim keep recording.
Oh,
so
cool.
We get to hear like 25 minutes of like
troubleshooting
project management.
Yeah.
Of this huge program, you know. And so they're running like they're like literally doing 24 hours a day construction down there. And apparently the way that they're telling everybody is like, the way that they're communicating the pace that they want is they're telling everybody, imagine an asteroid is hitting the Earth in 8 days. That's the schedule we're working on.
Crazy. Maybe there is one. Fuck.
Yeah. Who knows? Yeah. I think that was more than 8 days ago. But yeah.
Okay. Maybe it's going to be like,
yeah, it's crazy, dude. Like, it was very, very cool video. I mean, I've got like a whole page of notes from the video from a bunch of
anything that applies to what you do or what we do.
One interesting thing was Elon said that he has five steps. He walked through the five steps that he applies to all manufacturing processes. So, you know, it is kind of interesting because, like, when we think about, like, engineering, it's always, like, make the process better. You know, that's the step. You know, you have to make everything better. His first step is make your requirements less dumb.
Yes. This is a lesson you taught me a while ago. If you have unrealistic tolerances, then it'll be impossible to make something. And right. you can scale that back. You can say, like, you know, if your tolerances are not unrealistic, but are hard to hold,
right,
then, you know, it's going to be harder to manufacture. So it's like, can you build into your process lower tolerances without the product depreciating?
Yeah, without it getting worse. Yeah, totally. So, yeah, like, you know, and he basically, one of the things he's saying about SpaceX is that every single person, like every single engineer, is a project owner. Like, if somebody comes to the propulsion guys and says, like, I don't think this part is needed, it's like not acceptable for that to be laughed off,
right,
or waved away. You know, like every single person can like help optimize other parts of the system.
That's company culture. You know what I mean? Or
like, yeah, 100%. But the old school companies, like, you know, Boeing, for instance, I think they very much have departments. This department is responsible for this thing.
Sure, and there's a lot of ego, and, you know, you're not going to tell me my part's not necessary.
Right. I don't know about that part, but I think that, you know, traditional large-scale engineering is very much about, like, components and subcomponents. You know, like, I'll assign you to work on this component, and then you'll just give me back a box that complies to my specifications.
Oh, I see. Okay, so it's just not as collaborative.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and there might be a lot of opportunities. So, like, you know, your box needs to be strong for whatever reason because of, you know, the specs of your thing that you're making. You know, could we maybe make that part of the structure to, you know, to use that box's strength to provide structural reinforcement rather than having structural reinforcement and your box? You know, because like when you're launching a spaceship, you know, like every single pound that you add to the spaceship is like 1 pound of stuff you can't take to space. So yeah, it's just super interesting the way that they have that very like collaborative culture, I guess.
Yeah.
So yeah, like Elon's five steps. Number one was make your requirements less dumb. Number two is try to remove the part of process. Number three is simplify or optimize the part of process. Number four is accelerate cycle time. And then number five is automate.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah.
You know, and I think that I do some stuff out of order according to those rules. So I'm trying to think a bit more about removing the part or process is a really big one. Like, you know, from a software, I've written a lot of software, right? And from a software perspective, the best code is no code.
Yeah, true.
Nothing to go wrong with it. No maintenance. No, you know, like if you can get rid of it, get rid of it.
Yes, keep it simple, stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to think about it. It's hard. You almost, like as somebody manufacturing a product, it's almost offensive to try to remove something.
Yeah, you have like an investment in, you know, you've made this thing beautiful. You've spent time optimizing it or whatever. Then someone comes along to you and is like, we don't even need that thing.
Right. Well, we've been thinking about this with, you know, as we start transferring stuff over to the Haas, it's like, can we, Mark and I were talking about this today, like this back purfling. It's like the same thing I was talking about at the very beginning. It's just on the back. It's like, we have to fit this purfling into this really tight corner. It's like, can we just make that not such a tight corner? Why not? I mean, it's our product. Like, let's just make that a radius. It'll go in easier. It'll affect the aesthetic of it, but not in a negative way. I mean, from our thinking, and it'll make the manufacturing easier.
100%.
So, yeah, no, it's, I mean, constant improvement, but with that principle, I think is a winning combo.
Yeah, so one really interesting example of this on Starship in SpaceX is, so on the Falcon rockets, they have what's called a reaction control system, which is basically like little rockets pointing in lots of different directions that allow them to change the orientation of the rocket when it's in space, right? Because you don't have any air to like push around or something, so you have to use rockets.
Cool.
So of course Starship needs a reaction control system too, but Falcon uses what's called a cold gas thruster system. So it's literally like super compressed air. I'm pretty sure they use nitrogen. You know, so they have a really high pressure nitrogen tank and they just like open and close a little solenoid and squirt some gas out into space, right? But they need more power than that for Starship. So they went through the whole process of developing what's called a hot gas thruster system. So it actually uses like liquid methane, liquid oxygen. You know, it's a full-on miniature rocket engine.
Cool.
And they had these, they were demonstrating them and everything. And then they realized that, so part of the way a rocket maintains its structural integrity is actually by keeping the tanks pressurized. Like if you have an empty soda can, you stand on it, it just squishes, right? But when it's full of pressure and it's super, super strong. So they actually have to like generate pressure by basically like vaporizing fuel. Like they'll be venting a lot of the time because you have, you know, liquid oxygen in there, super, super cold, but it's always heating up. It's always warming up a little bit and turning into large quantities of gas. So most rockets actually have to vent the fuel tanks, you know, every couple of minutes or whatever, just to keep the pressure reasonable. And they were like, why don't we just use that gas as our reaction control thrusters?
So
they deleted they'd built these like rocket engines specifically for this. Like they'd gone through a whole development process and they were like, yeah, let's just get rid of that.
Okay. Crazy. So do they have to gas these things off though? Cause normally, you know, like maybe they didn't want to move the rocket this way or that way or this, you know, but they have to be,
it has to be vented.
It has to be vented. So they're using that as propulsion, but when they don't need propulsion, are they still having to vent it and get propulsion?
They are, but you can imagine if you have thrusters pointing in every direction.
Right, you can counterbalance.
If you want to do a neutral burn, you just burn in opposite directions at the same time. Mm-hmm. Like you just vent gas in the two opposite directions.
Clever bastards.
Yeah, so and literally during the like walk around the interview, Tim, the everyday astronaut, he asks, oh, are you going to do that same thing with Starship? And Elon just gets this look on his face. He's like, we haven't talked about that. I guess we should do that. We'll probably do that.
Cool.
You know? So yeah, it's super interesting. If you are at all interested in space, it is a little jargon heavy, a little technical because, you know, they're both space nerds and they're just kind of having a conversation, not really dumbing it down. But it's, I think one of the things that got to me most is the scale of the operations. Mm. Like when you see a photo from far away, you're like, oh, that's a really big crane. You know, it looks like a big crane, but then they're standing next to the crane and the top of their head doesn't even come up to the top of the tank treads on the crane.
Right. Yeah. The perspective is important.
Yeah. Like these things are huge. So yeah, it was just super, super cool to see that.
All right. Well, we've all got homework to
go watch it
for next week.
Yeah.
So much. Aaron, we're coming up onto an hour and 20 minutes. We're well over budget.
All right, we're done then.
We're going to have to pick this up next week.
No worries at all. That's what I said when I started this rambling.
You did warn everyone.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is anybody still listening? Hello?
Hello? I actually had someone message the other day and say that he messaged me a screenshot of the Everyday Astronaut tour and said, this is all your fault. Space talk is my favorite part of the show.
Not my random nonsense. Come on.
No.
That's fair.
All right, buddy. Well, we should wrap it up by the sounds of it.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'll look forward to chatting with you next week.
Good to
be back.
Yeah, absolutely. Hope everyone has a great week and we will speak to you again next
Thanks
week.
Thanks for tuning in.
Bye.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hurry into Menards and save big money. Stock up on water softener Salt for softer skin and cleaner clothes. Diamond Crystal is the perfect choice of salt to minimize water softener tank residue. It helps your soaps and detergents clean better while increasing the life of your appliances and plumbing. Save big on Diamond Crystal products at Menards. And don't forget to check out the flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.